The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from National Geographic. But before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, I need to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to read about the search for Shackleton's lost ship. Joel K. Burns Jr.'s article appeared in the January 2025 issue of National Geographic. Now, we first need to offer some background for the story. A two-page graphic, it's titled Saga of Survival, provides what happened to the crew and their ship, the Endurance, on its final voyage. Now, we're going to tell this story using a timeline. It begins on August 1st, 1914. That's when the Endurance and its captain, Ernest Shackleton, depart from London. They arrive in Buenos Aires, Argentina, on October 9th of 1914, where the ship remains in port through October 26th of the same year. Now, on that date, the ship heads to British-owned South Georgia Island. It arrives there around November 5th and remains there through December 5th. Now, after departing the island on December 5th, the ship becomes trapped in pack ice on January 18th, 1915, this happening off the coast of Queen Maud Island near Reiser-Larsen Ice Shelf. Now, the crew had gone ashore a day earlier to shelter from a storm. They were not far from where they had hoped to make landfall. After the ship becomes trapped in ice, the vessel and crew start to drift in pack ice, riding a gyre, which is a spiral flow of water covering a wide area in the Weddell Sea off the coast of Antarctica. Now, keep in mind that the ship had a reinforced 52-inch thick bow designed to break through the Weddell Sea's outer pack ice. Current in the Weddell Sea drives ice in a clockwise pattern along the Antarctic Peninsula. Now, Shackleton knew the ice would carry the ship northward and, with luck, maybe toward open water. On October 27, 1915, the crew abandons Endurance after ice begins to crush the ship over 3 days, and the ship sinks November 21, 1915, so just over a year after it departed. The crew then makes camp on the pack ice. Ice flows continue to carry them northward in the Weddell Sea for several months. Now, between April 9th and April 15th, 1916, the crew board lifeboats and row the rough seas until they spot Elephant Island. Now there, most of the crew awaits rescue from April 24th to August 30th, 1916. And at the same time, Shackleton and six of his crew members go in search of help in another boat. They sail 800 miles across dangerous waters on a 22-foot lifeboat. They finally reach South Georgia Island, and then they trek across the ice to the Grytviken whaling station, arriving there on May 20th, 1916. They then put together a rescue mission for the crew that remains on Elephant Island. Now, keep in mind all this taking place off the coast of Antarctica. The first three rescue attempts fail because of impassable ice. On the fourth try, they successfully reach the remaining crew, and they leave Elephant Island on April 30th, 1916. Again, all this takes place between August 1914 and April 1916. Among those aboard the Endurance, photographer Frank Hurley. Now, he took pictures using early photographic techniques that captured what the crew and ship endured during their nearly two-year ordeal. Writer Nick Martin is going to provide some details about Hurley's pictures and how they survived. So we're going to head for that graphic right now. And I'll read a little caption. First of all, they're holding the Endurance crew enshrined in legend, thanks in part to photographer Frank Hurley's decision his work would make it home, too. Many of his glass plates, that's the technique they used, like the one shown in the picture on this page, are now held by the Royal Geographic Society in London. And the glass plate's basically a negative, if you will, okay? But it's in glass. Now, also, as we look at this as a picture of what would be 35-millimeter film, Hurley wasted no time making his photos and film footage public. Following the crew's return, he directed the 1919 film South, which detailed the journey and wildlife of Antarctica. Hurley's nitrate motion picture negatives, that's what's pictured here, are now held by the BFI National Archive. Now, let's talk about more of how these pictures survived. An endurance photographer's prescient instinct to save his negatives and disaster cemented the ship's place in history. The images are well known, and one, ice blocks surround the famous three-masted ship as grinning crew members and thick-furred dogs mill about a makeshift Antarctic camp. The scene belies the drama that went into saving the footage and photographs taken by endurance photographer Frank Hurley. After the crippled vessel began to take on water, Hurley braved the flooding inner cabins to retrieve his negatives, glass plates, celluloid, and nitrate motion picture that he had stored in soldered tin boxes to protect them. In the following months, the negatives traveled with the men across the ice and then over the sea to Elephant Island, where Hurley and the crew survived for 4 months before being rescued. Today, nearly 150 glass plates and 39 celluloid negatives are held by the Royal Geographic Society. In London, Jamie Owen, tasked with managing and preserving the organization's extensive photographic collections, marvels at their condition. If you leave out the preservation side of it, this almost perfect state they're in at the moment is amazing given the journey they've been on, he says. RGS has digitized the collection to ensure that the public can view the images, but the originals are untouched. In fact, short of the rare royal dignitary, National Geographic is the only institution to have been granted direct access to Hurley's glass plates for the sake of this story and a documentary. And that article, again, by Nick Martin, okay? So, next we're going to read the main story, The Search for Shackleton's Lost Ship. And I want to inject here, excuse me just a second. It's time of year with cold weather, it gets to my throat. But anyway, Geographic editors and writer Joel K. Bourne's article explain how a determined crew of shipwreck hunters found the Endurance under Antarctic ice and solved one of the exploration's greatest mysteries. Now, this discovery actually came in 2022 at a depth of 18,000, I'm sorry, a depth of 9,000, I'm reading the wrong number here, 9,869 feet in the Weddell Sea. So, let's now have the story of this amazing discovery. The Weddell Sea hides its secrets well. John Shears and Minson Bound knew that better than anyone else, at least anyone alive. The two men had spent years searching for Weddell's greatest treasure. Now standing on sea ice amid the brutal polar sea, they were ready to admit defeat. They had climbed from their massive icebreaker to take a walk and have a brief chat and discuss how to break the news to the world that they had failed again. The treasure they were hunting was the famous Endurance, the three-mast barkentine that carried Ernest Shackleton and his 27-man crew to the Antarctic in 1914 before being crushed by pack ice and swallowed by the Weddell, as we just explained. Now, the failed expedition Shackleton meant to land the ship and cross the continent on foot instead became a saga of survival and one of the best documented tales of the great age of polar exploration. Shackleton, as we know by now, rallied his shipwrecked crew, and together they battled blizzards, frostbite, and dwindling supplies. They all survived, and their story inspired countless books and movies. But it was the stricken ship that became the symbol of their epic adventure. Shears, a 25-year veteran of the British Antarctic Survey, and Bound, a renowned Oxford maritime archaeologist, had already come up empty in a previous expedition to find the ship. That hunt in 2019 yielded painful lessons, but also critical insights that they now employed on their return to the waters off Antarctica. Yet once again, their experience in the Weddell was echoing that of Shackleton, who had failed three times to reach his grail of the South Pole. Unlike the Endurance's expedition leader, the two had at their disposal such modern tools as satellite ice forecast, heavy-lift helicopters, and the latest underwater robots with side-scan sonar. They also had the 440-foot steel-hulled icebreaker S.A. Agalost II and its skilled crew. Even so, Shears and Bound recognized that time was running out. Their expedition had already been granted one extension, but winter was closing in. The same pack ice that had imprisoned the Endurance could swiftly freeze up around the Agulhas, too. They both knew that in 2 days the icebreaker would have to start its escape or risk getting trapped. A nautical marvel, the 144-foot-long Endurance, was said to be among the strongest wooden ships of its day. It was built of massive beams of Norwegian fir, sheathed with dense greenheart, and finished with a 7-foot-thick keel of solid oak. Strong as it was, the ship was designed for comparatively leisure pursuits to carry rich sportsmen to the edge of the Arctic ice for polar bear hunts. After purchasing the vessel, Shackleton modified it to accommodate the expedition's cargo and crew, adding kennels to house several dozen sled dogs, and changing the name of the stern. After 9 months stuck in the pack, the Endurance rudder and stern post were wrenched away by the pressure of the ice, opening holes for the water to pour in. At 5 p.m. on November 21, 1915, the men encamped on an ice floe and, watching in horror, spotted the stern rise in the air. "She's gone, boys," was all Shackleton could muster as the ship slid down into her frigid grave. No one ever expected to see the stout little ship again. Even as deep ocean wrecks like the Titanic and the Bismarck were discovered with increasingly advanced subsea technology, the extreme expense and technical challenge of exploring beneath the Weddell's ice made any attempt to find Shackleton's barkentine wishful thinking. That is, until 2018, when the Flotilla Foundation, a Netherlands-based marine protection organization, announced it was funding the first-ever mission to uncover the Endurance. Shears was appointed as the expedition leader and Bound as the director of exploration, with the mission set to begin in early 2019. Even with the latest underwater vehicles from the Marines robotics company, Ocean Infinity, the crew barely made headway in the Weddell, one of the most inhospitable places on the planet. Tracking the pattern of ice flows and the direction of speed of pack ice year to year was still equal parts science and guessing games, and determining the right section of the seafloor to comb required placing faith in century-old coordinates. The first expedition taught Shears and Bound to answer a pair of critical questions that would help them organize their next hunt. Were they using the right tools? Were they searching in the exact right spot? The expedition was arduous from the start. Even before the team could reach the search area, they were waylaid by malfunctions. During the first deep water trial of their remotely operated vehicle, or ROV, a tethered submersible carrying cameras that would survey the wreck, the electronics capsule imploded. The team wasted most of a week waiting at an airstrip for spare parts that never came. They gave up the wait and headed for the search area, where they had time for two dives with their main undersea bloodhound, a bright orange state-of-the-art autonomous underwater vehicle, or AUV. It's called the Huygens 6000, that had been configured, that had been configured to search the seabed under the ice with powerful side-scan sonar. It made a beautiful start, covering 7 of the 11 pre-programmed lines within the search box that Bound believed contained the Endurance. Then the $6 million robot vanished without a trace, taking all its precious data and the team's chances for success with it. Shears, Bound, and the crew admitted defeat. In August 2020, Shears received a phone call from David Lamont, the former governor of the Falkland Islands and then chair of the Falklands Maritime Heritage Trust, an organization in the United Kingdom tasked with preserving the history of the islands and their adjacent seas. To Shears' amazement, Lamont said his group could fund another attempt. Shears and Bound recognized they needed to change their approach. The trust engaged Nico Vincent as deputy expedition leader and subsea project manager. One of the most experienced sea subsea engineers in the business, Vincent has helped locate hundreds of sunken ships and aircraft with teams of subsea experts. After Vincent was invited to join the expedition, he and his team began poring over the detailed report of the 2019 effort drafted by their colleague, Claire Samuel Martin. One pressing conclusion, the team needed to use a different underwater vehicle. The Hugin 6000 is the most effective subsea vehicle in the world, says Vincent, but it wasn't right for a job in this extreme frozen environment. When you drive to the top of a mountain where you have ice and snow, you don't go there in a Formula One. You go on a four-wheel drive, he said. For the next expedition, two Saab Sabretooths, smaller vehicles that would stay connected to the ship with a Kevlar-wrapped fiber-optic cable, were chosen by Ocean Infinity. The subsea team visited the Saab test facility in Sweden for training and testing of the Sabretooths. There, Vincent took note of the high-tech winch system, which would be used to deploy them and pay out the fragile cable. But, as he walked around, he also spotted under a tarp an old winch that had been retired by the Finnish Navy. The unit was 20 years old, but it was tried and true. When he asked the Saab engineers to clean it up and send it along, they balked. Unrelenting, Vincent demanded that the old winch be included in a deal for the Sabretooths as the spare of the spare. Another question concerned where this expedition would deploy the Sabretooths. Shears asked for a reassessment of the search box with the hope of being as precise as possible in establishing where they would scan the seabed. To do so, they would reach back into history and reanalyze the records made by the Endurance's Captain Frank Worsley and the ship's physicist, Reginald James. Even though the Endurance's skipper left precise coordinates of the ship's last location before it sank, it was really just his best estimate, says Frank Reed, a celestial navigation expert affiliated with Mystic Seaport Museum in Connecticut, who was tasked with checking the accuracy of Worsley's position. The pack ice that ensnared the ship had been moving at a speed of about 4 nautical miles a day, swept north by a current called the Weddell Gyre. Now, the Endurance was blown back south by strong northerlies 2 days before it sank, when Worsley couldn't see his sun. Now, his coordinates for the Endurance's last position were taken the day after the ship sank from the crew's camp on ice in a mile and a half away. Now, Worsley's measure of longitude also depended on the ship's chronometers, only one of which was working properly by the time the ship sank. Researchers have long believed even the chronometer was off, creating a potential margin of error of several miles. But Worsley went beyond his normal navigational duties, says Reeds. At James' suggestion, the two men corrected the chronometer error with oculations, using the ship's small telescope to mark the precise time known stars would appear behind the moon. Oculation, says Reeds, had typically been used by land-based astronomers, not mariners. It was hard and fairly long work. It might have taken them 2 or 3 hours to work up an oculation to get time out of it, but time they had. Reed's analysis of the work led him to estimate the ship's true position roughly 3 nautical miles southeast of Worsley's estimate. Vincent's team used Reed's report to draw the final box 15 by 8 nautical miles, relatively small compared with Vincent's past searches. Once the Weddell began throwing ice blocks in their way, though, even the area began to seem vast, a daunting void. Vincent likes to say that he never devises a plan B, but rather a plan 2. Having plan B, he thinks, invokes the alphabet and insinuates a limit of only 26 options. Now, when the Auguless II sailed to the Weddell Sea in 2022, Vincent was already on his third plan as the Sabretooth splashed into the frigid open water to begin the hunt. Almost immediately, the vehicle's major failure alarm sounded. One of the AUV's 6 thrusters was inoperable, hampering the sub's ability to maneuver. Up it came, thruster replaced, batteries charged. The next day, the Sabretooth plunged down again. The batteries meant to last 9 hours were drained in 5. Like a fishing rod with the drag crank down too tight, the new winch was putting too much pressure on the AUV's tether. Then the winch failed altogether. The crew brought out the backup, but similar issues ensued. Finally, J.C. Callion, a former French Navy captain and the offshore manager of Vincent's team, suggested bringing out the old Finnish winch. It worked like a charm, dropping the tension on the tether and extending the AUV's battery life while making only one simple task, or simple ask, I should say. The old lady didn't like the cold, says Vincent, so we were obliged to build a tent over her and put a heater in there. Intuitive as Vincent's call had been, the try-up was brief. The ensuing 17 days resulted in a string of fruitless searches along the seafloor. February turned into March. The weather deteriorated rapidly, with wind chill on the back deck of the Agulhas II plummeting to minus 14 degrees Fahrenheit, raising the threat of frostbite and hypothermia, and now a massive flow of hard multi-year ice containing an iceberg had moved into the area, covering a third of the search box. The Weddell was baring its teeth. Now, come March 5th, despair began to set in. The team had covered 81% of the search box and found only a few tantalizing mud-covered spars and lumps of coal. Manson was in his cabin writing a status report explaining that the wreck had not yet been found. On the sea ice, away from the rest of the crew aboard the ship, Schierzenbaum wondered how they would break the news to the funders and thousands of schoolchildren following the expedition online through the educational program Reach the World. But as the Shears walked, a peculiar feeling came over the stoic expedition leader. He turned to Bound. "You know, Minson, it's going to be a good day today. I think she's beneath our feet." Just after 4 p.m., Vincent received a call on his radio. It was Collins, relaying a message from Sabretooth pilot Robbie McGonigal, who was working out of the operations container, a mobile 3-seat 9-by-7-foot room filled with computer monitors and controls for the AUV. Collins called Vincent that they had a sonar blip, a very large blip. Vincent scrambled to the back deck and told McGonigal to make a U-turn with the AUV. The batteries were running low, but the operators nonetheless switched the vehicle's sensors from high to low-frequency sonar to produce a more detailed image. The visual that popped up on the monitor, Vincent recalls, was jarring. A ship's mast and upper deck came into view. "Nico, we have to get back to the surface," McGonigal said. "We're at very, very low power." No, Vincent said. "I want to see wood with the camera. Until we see wood, we have clues, but no proof." McGonigal reluctantly brought the saber-tooth around for another pass, switching on the lights and video camera. For the next 30 seconds, all Vincent could hear was the whir of computers and his own heartbeat as the scene 10,000 feet below him unfolded. Years of planning and preparation by Shears, Bound, and Vincent, and two of the largest non-governmental Antarctic expeditions ever launched, all hung on what they would see next. Out of the abysmal darkness, a century's worth of wonder, history, and legend filled the screen. The port side of the Endurance, still resplendent in black and white paint, as if it sank yesterday, emerged from the gloom. Vincent reveled in the historic moment. Then everything went dark. The AUV crew wanted to celebrate, but Vincent wouldn't have it. The clock was ticking, and they had 48 hours to swap out the Sabretooth sonar package for an ultra-high-definition camera and a laser scanner that was later used to create a 3D facsimile of the wreck with 1 millimeter resolution and conduct one of the most important maritime archaeological surveys in recent history. Vincent ordered that no word of the discovery leave the container. He composed himself and climbed to the bridge with the high-sea sonar image on his phone. Shears and Bound, out on the ice, had been making their way back to the ship. As soon as their feet hit the deck, they heard the ship's loudspeaker. "Shears and Bound to the bridge! Shears and Bound to the bridge!" They raced there, only to find Vincent looking utterly dejected. What has happened?" Shears said. Vincent stood up and smiled, holding up his phone in the sonar image. "Gents, let me introduce you to the Endurance." Shears was stunned. He dropped his English reserve and gave Vincent a bear hug. The men returned to the operations container to review the video footage and later made their way to the rear deck to watch the retrieval of the saber-tooth. When it was finally winched on the board, cheers echoed across the ice. During their practice runs in the months leading up to the discovery, an AUV retrieval and sonar-to-camera swap took them 36 hours. That day, the subsea crew did it in 13. The swift transition allowed them to make 2 dives, giving them 8 hours with the wreck. The resulting images were so detailed, researchers could pick out the flare gun on the deck. Even though Bound had predicted the wreck was well-preserved, he wasn't prepared for the pristine condition of the ship on the screen. At one point, they saw leather boots that possibly belonged to Frank Wilde, Shackleton's right-hand man. They then hovered over the three holes that the ship's carpenter Henry Chippy McNish and photographer Frank Hurley had cut in the deck to retrieve several tons of supplies before the ship sank, provisions that saved the crew's lives. It was just mind-blowing, Bound said, of seeing the ship, which lay within an extended area of his 2019 search box. The absolute pinnacle of my life. On the way back to its home port in South Africa, the Agulhas II was given special permission to make one more stop at the now-abandoned whaling station at Grytviken on South Georgia Island, where in 1922, Shackleton was laid to rest after suffering a massive heart attack during his final expedition, an attempt to circumnavigate Antarctica. It was noted that the Endurance had been found 100 years to the day after the great polar explorer was buried. The expedition team made the pilgrimage to the graveyard, as did many of the ship's crew, a polyglot group of global mariners. The expedition principal said a few words, and Shears in particular thanked the team for their tremendous efforts. I think Shackleton realized that to be successful, to achieve things, you just can't do it on your own, says Shears. That's the big lesson for me. You're only as good as the team around you. The hard-won discovery of Shackleton's ship by some tenacious teams seemed to be a fitting tribute to the man who did so much to hold his men together, whose family motto was Fortitudine Vincimus. By endurance, we conquer. What a story. Well, next, we're going to read Our Sunken Ships from the Civil War Still Lying in the Chattahoochee. And this is going to be an excerpt from this article. And it's basically what a historian says, written by Kelby Hutchinson, the article originally written for the Columbus, Georgia Ledger Inquirer, and appeared in the June 10, 2023 online edition of the News and Observer. And basically, the Chattahoochee River has become a tourist attraction for kayaking and whitewater rafting, but some may not know the history that lies just beneath their paddles. The site of the last battle of the Civil War took place as Brigadier General James H. Wilson crossed the Chattahoochee into the Columbus, where fierce fighting took many lives and left the city in ruins. Now, more than a century and a half later, artifacts from that battle may still lie in the aquatic tomb at the bottom of the Chattahoochee River. Holly Waite, the executive director of the National Civil War Naval Museum in Columbus, says part of a sunken ship still lies at the bottom of the river, and it's possible artifacts such as cannonballs may as well. Part of what fuels the belief more artifacts rest at the bottom is because, she said, three cannons have been retrieved from the river over the years, and two are now part of the museum, with the third lying in a graveyard in downtown Columbus. During the Battle of Columbus, Union soldiers set fire to a ship, which now sets sail on mock waters in the museum. The ironclad named the CSS Jackson, also called the Muskogee, was set ablaze and was set adrift until it found its way to the bottom of the river. The ship was excavated nearly a century after its burning in 1865 in an effort led by J.W. Woodruff in 1961, according to the museum's website. The three cannons were from the CSS Jackson, according to Waite, one located on the river and still off from time to time on special occasions, according to Waite. Our ship set off, I should say. Now, however, while the Jackson was able to be recovered, part of one ship destroyed in the battle is still in the river. Waite said the bow end of the CSS Chattahoochee still lies somewhere at the bottom of the river, and it shares a name with that. The museum is currently in possession of the stern of the ship. It was set on fire by the very men who commanded the ship so it wouldn't fall into the hands of Union soldiers, according to the museum's website. In 1984, East Carolina University and Confederate Naval Museum set out to relocate the CSS Chattahoochee, determine its condition, and figure out the potential for research, recovery, and exhibition, according to a page on the University of Georgia's archaeological site. And that, my friends, brings us to the end of today's Journey of Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us again next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, you may direct them to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.